been looking at the various themes that James discusses in this epistle. And when we were last in the study of James before our meeting, we were looking at this particular section, chapter 2, verses 1 through 13, wherein James is talking about the fair treatment of other people and not committing the sin of partiality, not showing partiality towards some over others. And ties in with so many of the things that he's been talking about throughout the epistle. So we want to begin here and look at the latter half of this section. We got through the first half of it, basically, before. We want to look at the latter half of it this morning. Good to have everybody here. As always, we want to begin class with a word of prayer, and we're going to ask Isaac Van der Merwe, if he would, to direct our minds as we bow. Let's look at this section. I'm not going to take time to read all 13 verses. The first seven verses we had talked about last time, just to refresh our memories, what was the particular example of showing partiality that James was concerned about? The first seven verses, what was the scenario he discussed with them that would be an example of showing partiality? Don't let that happen again. He's going to call on Ralph. He's been in the hospital, anxious to answer this question, and you stole it from him. A little partiality on your part there, isn't it? But you're exactly right. The scenario that he's envisioning here, that obviously he saw as a real potential problem, and we talked about that last time, the idea of a rich man and special deference being shown to a wealthy man because of the benefits that could perhaps accrue to you if you were the friend of a wealthy man and that status and all those things that we talked about. I'm not going to rehearse all of that, but just to bring that to your attention. And so when we look now at verses 8 and following, he says, if, however, you are fulfilling the royal law according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you are doing well. But if you show partiality, you are committing sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. For whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles in one point, he has become guilty of all. For he who said, "Do not commit adultery," also said, "Do not commit murder." Now, if you do not commit adultery, but do commit murder, you have become a transgressor of the law. So speak and so act as those who are to be judged by the law of liberty. For judgment will be merciless to one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. All right, now this is the section that we want to address in this morning's class. And you'll notice that he talks here about the royal law. He talks about fulfilling the royal law in this entire section. And I want us to ask the question here, what exactly does he mean by the royal law? And I think as we ask that question, we need to also note the fact that in verses 9 through 11, he speaks of this royal law, seems to be referring to the same law that he has in mind. He calls it the law in verses 9 through 11. And in verse 12, he speaks of it as the law of liberty. Also uses that same expression back in chapter 1, verse 25, but one who looks intently at the perfect law, the law of liberty, and abides by it, not having become a forgetful hearer but an effectual doer, this man will be blessed by what he does. So there's some synonymous terminology, or not synonymous exactly, but there are some interchangeable terms that James seems to be using here as he speaks about this royal law and are fulfilling the royal law by, in this context, not showing partiality one toward the other. So what does he mean by this royal law? Why does anybody have a thought on that? What's he mean by the royal law, and why call it the royal law? Mickey?
The royal law is committed by a king.
Okay. I think that's the thing that would certainly come to our mind. Seems to be referring to the law or the teaching of Jesus Christ, who is our King, and that certainly would explain why it would be called this royal law. It's the law of King Jesus. And you can certainly appreciate why he would use the expression law of liberty in regard to the law or the teaching of Jesus Christ. Being a disciple of Jesus Christ and following his teaching is what gives us liberty. It gives us freedom from sin. You might recall in John chapter 8, verses 31 and 32, that's where Jesus said that if you are his disciple, then he will set you free. And of course, he got in that discussion with the Jews who were upset that he had suggested that they were enslaved, and he made the point that if you're enslaved or that they were enslaved to sin. And so he talked about being his disciple, following his teaching, providing them with liberty. And so I think that certainly makes sense here to think of this law of, or this royal law, this law of liberty, as the law or the teaching of Christ. But I think we have to go further with this than just to say that. Because when you look at the examples that James uses here, when he talks about fulfilling this royal law, this law of liberty, do you notice that all of his examples come from the law of Moses? In fact, he's quoting passages from the law of Moses. In fact, he speaks of the royal law, and quotes the passage, "Love your neighbor as yourself," from Leviticus 17. And the examples of violating this, he says, "You shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder," and those are of course two of the Ten Commandments from that law of Moses system. And so I think we have to go a little bit further with this and ask this question: why are James' examples all from the law of Moses if the royal law he's talking about is this law from King Jesus, this law of King Jesus that sets us free? And I think this is the answer to that question, and it's an important point that sometimes it seems to me that we as disciples of Jesus miss. It was the law of Moses was the foundation for Jesus' teaching. In fact, if you really want to understand Jesus' teaching, you've got to understand that in terms of the law of Moses and the fact that Jesus, though yes, he was presenting a new covenant, and yes, the New Testament teaches that this new covenant was going to supersede the old covenant, and yes, the Mosaic system on its own was a system that could not bring redemption and liberty, but only brought condemnation. But the teaching of Jesus and the new covenant brings life and liberty. All that's true. But I think sometimes we make such a sharp demarcation between the Mosaic law and then the teaching of Jesus that we act as if or think as if there's just no connection. That's a mistake. That's a grave mistake to make. Because when you look very carefully at Jesus' teaching and the teaching of the New Testament, what you see is that Jesus and his apostles are saying that the law of Moses' teaching, that was the foundation for the teaching of Jesus. In fact, what Jesus really was doing was explaining those precepts of the law of Moses and the underlying moral principles that they were pointing to, and how those principles that God was introducing with the Mosaic law, how those principles really should be implemented in every person's life for him to be a moral individual. That's really what Jesus is getting at in Matthew 5, verses 17 and following in his Sermon on the Mount, when he says, "Do not think I came to abolish the law, but to fulfill it." He didn't mean by that just that he was fulfilling Old Testament prophecy. That's not the context of that statement. In the Sermon on the Mount, he gives all these illustrations of what the Pharisees were teaching the people from the law of Moses, and Jesus then is saying, "But I say unto you," and he explains what the law of Moses principles really were trying to get at as far as the moral behavior of the people. So I think we need to understand that when we look at what James is saying about the royal law. Yes, it's the teaching of Jesus. But it's the teaching of Jesus which is an explication of the moral principles that the law of Moses was introducing. And that's what Jesus, this ultimate prophet that God was sending, was doing. He was showing these moral principles that the law of Moses was laying the foundation for. Does that make some sense to everybody? That's a crucial point that so often people miss. And I also want you to see when you look at what James says here in the context, that when he gives a summary of this royal law, this teaching of King Jesus, which is an explication of the principles of the law of Moses, he emphasizes it as love your neighbor as yourself. Does everybody see this? "If, however, you are fulfilling the royal law according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you are doing well." But then he goes on to show that partiality, or showing partiality, would be a violation of that. So, what does he mean by the royal law? Well, it's the teaching of King Jesus. But it's the teaching of King Jesus as he was explicating the law of Moses principles, which, as Jesus himself emphasized, were all summed up in love God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and as far as your dealings with your fellow man, the royal law was love your neighbor as yourself. And so Jesus, in his teaching, was trying to show the Jewish people just what loving your neighbor really meant. And so that's what James is really doing here. He's sort of amplifying Jesus' teaching and applying it specifically to the area of showing partiality. And this is where James realizes these Jewish Christians are weak in. They're not seeing that showing partiality is a violation of the very teaching of King Jesus, the very teaching that the law of Moses was trying to add and break, the very concept of morality towards your fellow man that God was wanting to teach. So he says, if you show partiality, you are committing sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. Now I'm going to go into that and look at this specific explanation that James gives for that, but I want to pause here. Comments or questions on what I've just said? I've kind of given you a little discourse there, and I want to make sure we don't have any comments or questions about what I just said. Everybody see the point about Jesus explicating the law of Moses and what loving your neighbor really was all about when the law taught that? Any comments on that? Okay. Well, then we'll move on. Very good. Now, he's just made the statement, if you show partiality, you are committing sin and are convicted by the law, that is, this royal law, and especially love your neighbor as yourself, you are convicted by that law as transgressors. And now he explains what he means by that. And I want us to focus in on this particular passage, because this is a passage that a lot of people are confused by. And they're confused by the logic of what James is saying, or why what he's saying would be logical. I think sometimes it doesn't seem logical what James says here. For whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles in one point, he has become guilty of all. For he who said, "Do not commit adultery," also said, "Do not commit murder." Now, if you do not commit adultery, but do commit murder, you have become a transgressor of the law. Now, what does he mean by this first statement? Whoever keeps the whole law yet stumbles in one point has become guilty of all. Does he mean by that if you refrain from committing adultery, but you do commit murder, well, then you really are an adulterer too? And you're really guilty of all of those other commandments that God said not to violate? I mean, is that what he means when he says if you stumble in one point, you become guilty of all? So if I tell a lie, well, I'm also an adulterer. I'm also a thief. I mean, is that what he means when he says if you stumble in one point, you become guilty of all? I see several of you shaking your heads. No. Well, I think the answer is no. Well, but what does he mean then? Okay, and why is that so? Even though you say you've committed murder and not adultery, what have you done from the broader perspective? Okay, does everyone see that? What you've done is you have transgressed God's law. And so I think that's what he means when he says he has become guilty of all. He means you've become guilty of the whole concept that God was after. But let me see if I can't illustrate this. Does everyone see that love your neighbor? And that's really what he's talking about, isn't it? I mean, that's the synopsis of the royal law that he's focusing in on, right? Okay, does everyone see that love of your neighbor, that's a generic commandment? And then so many of the other commandments that say don't do this, don't do that, are really an application of that principle. Like if someone commits adultery, you know, there was a specific commandment, of course, from God, thou shalt not commit adultery. But does everyone see that really is a violation of the broader principle of loving your neighbor? If you love your neighbor, you're not going to commit adultery with his wife. Right? Does everyone see that the commandment, thou shalt not murder, that really is an application of the generic principle you love your neighbor as yourself. If you really love your neighbor, you're not going to go over there and murder him, are you? In fact, isn't that really what Jesus meant when he said that all the law and the prophets, all those commandments, all hang upon two fundamental commandments, two principles: love God with everything you have and love your neighbor as yourself. In fact, we oftentimes make the point that, if I think Brother Billingsley made this statement in the meeting in one of his sermons, that really the first four of the Ten Commandments, if you just took those commandments from the Law of Moses, just the Ten Commandments, the first four of those pertain to your relationship with God. And then starting with love your, or honor your father and mother, and then going all the way down to the tenth commandment, thou shalt not covet, all of those commandments, 4 through 10, are all really under this principle: love your neighbor as yourself. And so that's what James is getting at. If you say, well, I've never committed adultery, well, that's great, but if you've committed murder, well, then you've violated the foundational commandment, which is the principle, the foundational law of love your neighbor as yourself. You've become guilty of the whole thing. So it may be that you haven't done this particular application, but if you have done anything which would be in violation of the commandment to love your neighbor as yourself, well, that's the royal law. That's the law of the king. That's this generic principle. You become guilty of everything. You become guilty of the whole. So he doesn't mean that if you don't commit adultery but you do commit murder, well, you're really an adulterer. But he does mean if you don't commit adultery and you do commit murder, you're not loving your neighbor. You are guilty of that. You're guilty of the foundational thing, the whole thing. Tony. Well, okay. I think probably he's just using that for rhetorical purposes. In other words, let's say, just hypothetically, not that it would really be true that only one commandment you ever violate, but let's just say that you keep all that the law of God says and you don't violate any of it except in one thing. Well, his point is, you're still guilty of the whole principle, of violating the whole principle. And as you said a moment ago, and he used the example of murdering, well, okay, you may have kept every other application of love your neighbor, but if you murder your neighbor, then you're violating the commandment to love your neighbor, and you're just as bad as somebody who had committed all these applications of failing to love your neighbor. You know, because, you know, here's a guy, he's committed adultery, he's committed murder too, he lies, he cheats his neighbor, all those things. Well, here's this other guy, he's kept all of those commandments, hadn't violated any of them, except one time he murdered a guy. Well, he's just as guilty of violating that royal law as the other guy. Because the royal law says, love your neighbor as yourself, and he didn't do that. Does that make some sense? I think I saw somebody else raise a hand a moment ago. Yeah.
With regard to favoritism, loving your neighbor as yourself, that means we would love every neighbor equally. And that also means the rich neighbor, the poor neighbor.
Absolutely. Okay.
And by extension, the adulterous neighbor and the murderous neighbor.
Okay. In fact, you're exactly seeing the point that James is leading up to. Does everyone see that James, in this paragraph, he's not trying to teach against adultery and murder as if that was the issue? That's just his example. That's his illustration. What's he really leading up to? What's the application of the love your neighbor principle that he's really talking about in this paragraph? Don't show partiality. And that's his point, and this is what you're seeing here. what these people would have said is, well, we've been fulfilling the teaching of Jesus. We've been fulfilling the royal law. We love our neighbor as ourselves. They would probably have said, name one of the commandments that we have violated. We haven't committed adultery. We haven't committed murder. We haven't stolen anything. We haven't done this or done that. But the point James is making is, though there's no just specific commandment in the law of Moses that really emphasizes this point about showing partiality to a wealthy man, you know. But James is saying, you really are still violating that commandment to love your neighbor as yourself when you show partiality to this rich guy who comes into your service and you fawn all over him and the poor man who can give you nothing and benefit you in no way at all. You just ignore him. And so that's the real point here in the context. That's what he's been leading up to. It's not a paragraph about adultery and murder. It's a paragraph about not showing partiality toward wealthy people and disregarding the poor man. And that's what so often we as disciples of Jesus probably don't think of it in that way. And we're probably just like the people that James was writing to. And if you know, we thought to ourselves, well, am I fulfilling the royal law of King Jesus to love your neighbor as yourself, as Jesus was explicating that for his disciples? Well, yes, I'm fulfilling that because I haven't murdered anybody and I haven't stolen anything and I haven't committed adultery. But if you show partiality to somebody who can benefit you and then disregard somebody who can't really give you a benefit, well, then you're not really loving your neighbor as yourself, are you? And his point is, you may have kept everything, but you stumbled in that one point, you've become guilty of the whole principle, the whole law. Does that make sense to everybody? That's a powerful teaching right there. And the way James argues his point is it's kind of like, well, wow. I mean, you're just kind of left speechless because there's nothing to say in response to that. He's exactly right. He's exactly right. What makes showing partiality wrong? Because it violates that. Just like that's what makes adultery wrong. That's what makes murder wrong. And so if you show partiality, you're just as big a violator of the royal law as the other guy who commits murder and adultery. Okay. Tom? Does everyone see why he probably chose murder and adultery as his two illustrations? Because of what you just said. You know, we think of those as really big sins, you know, obvious sins. You know. And so, of course, those are the illustrations. But his point is, you know, yeah, you're just as guilty if there are others that maybe are less obvious or less or viewed as less serious by people generally. You know, that's not the way we should view them. That's a good point. Andre, you, I think, raise your hand too. Did he steal your thunder with that comment? Was that your comment, really? You're exactly right. In fact, let's just go with that a little bit here. I mean, I abbreviated the commandment. It's not love your neighbor. It's love your neighbor as yourself. So isn't the point of that that you ask yourself, well, how would I feel about that? What, you know, how would I feel if someone did that to me? Would that be something I would like? You know. And of course, that's how you judge. whether or not you're really loving your neighbor as yourself. Isn't that what Jesus said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you? I mean, that's, he's explaining what all that means, how you should think of it. So how would you feel if somebody showed partiality to this person and disregarded you because you didn't have as much money or as much social status as that guy? Or you're a different race, your skin's a different color, or your background, you're not as educated as that person, you're not as high class as that person, and so, you know, those people disregard you and treat you as if you're not worthy of their attention, but boy, they fawn all over the person that's, you know, in their class or above their class, you know. How would you feel if somebody treated you that way? Well, if you wouldn't like that, then how can you treat them that way? Are you loving your neighbor as yourself? I mean, that's really what he's getting at. Yeah. I think Mickey was first and then Pat.
I just wanted to say, this kind of study convicts us all. To be really honest and look at ourselves, it's, I don't want to say it's human nature,
we think it's a lesser thing. Yeah.
It's lesser. Yeah. We all think that, you know, that it's not that bad.
Right, right.
But every one of us choose one over another. And this is really a crossroad.
And that's why James is making this point, because it is our tendency as human beings. It was their tendency to kind of downplay partiality. It's not that big a deal, because they weren't committing the serious sins of murder and adultery and all that. And I think your point's just so right on target. I mean, this is what we all need to be indicted by and really think about. Pat?
What do you do when you have a personal relationship with someone who is without Christian and does everything about them to lie and voice to be done? You also have a personal relationship with somebody who shows complete disregard for anybody else, disrespect toward you, and doing so many things that's not right. How do you handle that situation?
Are you talking about, like, the issue of, like, extending fellowship to a erring Christian or that issue? Well, of course, I mean, if I'm understanding what you're asking, you know, Jesus' teaching was to his disciples, if you have, and this would apply to any disciple, so it's applied without partiality, a disciple who's rejecting Jesus' teaching, and they maybe have been a disciple, but now they've just rejected that and gone back, well then you can't treat them as if they were a disciple. Now, he doesn't mean by that that you treat them in an ungodly way, but you can't regard them as if they were a faithful disciple when they have obviously made it clear that they're not. And that's not showing partiality to one over the other. That is applicable and applied equally to everybody. Now, I'll tell you what would be an example of applying that with partiality. You remember in 1 Corinthians 5, what the problem was at Corinth with the incestuous man? It wasn't just that there was an incestuous man. What's the real problem Paul's addressing in 1 Corinthians 5? Who's he getting on to? The church had tolerated the incestuous man. And it seems pretty clear to me in the overall context, because that's right after he's been talking about, you know, the schisms and the I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, and the divide themselves up into these groups, you know. Seems pretty obvious that the reason why they tolerated that on the part of the incestuous man and had done nothing about it, had not disciplined him, but were still treating him as if he were a faithful Christian, is because he obviously was somebody of importance in that church and had some clout, or at least in their minds he did, and they had done nothing about that. And I've seen that happen. Sometimes a person who maybe has been a leader in a church, and yet then when he goes into sin, well, then people don't do anything about that. But now if it was somebody who was on the periphery of the membership, who really didn't offer that much to the group, but boy, we're quick to jump on his sin. And the point that Paul's making is you should have already judged that incestuous man for his sin. And he says, you have become arrogant about all of this. And so it seems to me that would be an example of showing partiality in your application of discipline. Now, that may not, I'm not sure if I really am addressing what you're asking, Pat, but am I? Okay, that would be what I would say about that. Somebody else have a response to what Pat has just said? Let's get that first. Mickey, go ahead. Yeah, you remember in 2 Thessalonians 3, like verse 15, when Paul's addressing that, he says, but do not regard him as an enemy, but admonish him as a brother. That is this erring brother. So, and yeah, he says to not associate with him, but yet don't treat him as an enemy either. So, you know, but that's to be applied across the board. Somebody else on Pat's question. Okay, Isaac and then Tony. Well, all right. Let's think about that. It seems to me it's the same love, but I think the degree of application of that is going to differ. Isn't that suggested by the term brother? I mean, that's applying it to the idea of family, kinsman. Don't you have a greater responsibility toward your family members than to the guy who's a stranger out there? Yes, you do. Now, that doesn't mean that you disregard the stranger, but there is a special relationship that you have with your kinsman. But of course, what's so wonderful about the gospel of Jesus Christ is that the attitude of God, and therefore our attitude should be, that even that guy who's not a Christian, potentially I want him to be my brother. And I'm going to do everything I can do to try to help him to become my brother. So, you know, in one sense, I think there is a difference in it, but and that's why you have all the emphasis upon brethren and love the brethren and all that. But potentially everybody is our potential brother, and we should want it that way. God does. Sure. Well, Isaac, yes and no. You know, sometimes those distinctions and those Greek words are really overdone. Yeah, I mean, it just depends on the context, you know. I'm a little hesitant sometimes. I hear this all the time. People say, well, agape is this higher form of love in the Greek language, and phileo was just a, you know, you like the person. Well, that's really not true. I mean, that's so overstated as to be wrong, really. I mean, you know, but it just depends on the context as to how the biblical writers are using those words in the context as to what they're meaning by it. So anyway, that's maybe another study that we can have. Tony, I think you raised your hand.
Yeah, in my opinion, and I'd say this before, when we talk about this partiality,
Well, that's true. And didn't Jesus have certain disciples of his that he was closer with, closer friends with? Well, yes, that's just clear. Okay, I think Irma, I think you raised your hand a moment ago. Which is still an expression of love, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's tough love, but it's love.
We understand that with our children, you know, we love them, so everything's free, but we don't grant that because that's not what their need is.
And aren't you glad she felt that way, Paul? No, I'm so glad that you said that, Irma. I think that's very well put. That, you know, sometimes people so distort the biblical teaching about disciplining an erring brother as if, oh, well, you're showing hatred or a lack of love for them. Well, if we understand what the Bible means by that and do it appropriately, it is an expression of love. And it's that tough love that you have to have as a parent with your child. But it's absolutely necessary. And I like how you put that. It's dependent upon the need of the person. That's very well said. Somebody else? Raise your hand. Yeah.
And some people would interpret it as showing partiality or showing that part of the community that we understand. I think that's also part of that.
Okay, yeah. Absolutely. And again, the problem with somebody who is maybe seeing that as, oh, we ought to condone sin or, you know, he doesn't really understand this royal law. He doesn't understand Jesus' teaching. Because there's no way that you could look at Jesus' teaching about these things and come away thinking, either extreme, that Jesus condoned sin, or the other extreme, that Jesus had no compassion or love for the sinner. I mean, so again, what he's talking about is the royal law, King Jesus, that's the explanation of all of this. Okay, so he concludes this by saying, so speak and so act as those who are to be judged by the law of liberty. For judgment will be merciless to one who has shown no judgment. Mercy triumphs over judgment. Now I want to take you back to the point Mickey said a moment ago. Mickey made a very strong point about these verses in James. They indict us, or I don't recall what term you used, but they convict us. Well, folks, now we got 4 minutes left in this class, but if we don't really get the point of verses 12 and 13, then we've wasted our time here. Because this is what makes this so important. Showing partiality or violating the commandment to love your neighbor as yourself in one area over here, that is absolutely a serious issue. And you better not, and I better not, just sort of relegate that to, well, but I don't do these major things, and so just kind of dismiss that. He says, you speak and so act as those who are to be judged by the law of liberty. On the judgment day, who are those people who are going to heaven? How would you answer that question? Who did Jesus say were those who are going to heaven and receive that eternal reward? Okay, or those who were his followers. Those are the ones he said he would give liberty and life to. If you are my disciples, I'll give you. Okay, now, you see what he's talking about? That law of the king is what's going to be the basis of judgment. In other words, are we really a disciple? The word disciple means that you are a follower of his teaching. Well, let's say I'm like the guy that James is talking about, and I show partiality, but I convince myself I'm a disciple because I don't murder and commit adultery and all that, but I show partiality, and I never bother to address that. I just continue to live that way. Am I really a follower of the royal law? No, I'm not. I'm not really a disciple of Jesus. And that's what's going to judge me on the last day. That law of liberty, that law that was intended to give me life, if I'm not fulfilling it, if I'm just rejecting that, well then, how can I expect on the day of judgment for God to extend me mercy when I've shown partiality and not extended mercy to somebody else? So here's the poor man. I disregard him because he doesn't benefit me. I don't really like him anyways. Not my race, not my education, not my social status, not my level of wealth. I don't really care for him that much. But this guy I zero in on. Okay, I've shown no mercy at all to this person over here. And I expect God on judgment day to then extend me mercy? I'm a disciple of Jesus, Lord. Then he's going to say, why didn't you fulfill the royal law of liberty? And love your neighbor as yourself. And I'm going to say, well, I didn't commit adultery or commit murder. And he's going to make this point, you know, but you show partiality and didn't show mercy and pity. I mean, this is why this is serious business. Because we can't convince ourselves, or I should say delude ourselves into thinking that we're really disciples of King Jesus and fulfilling his royal law when we're just ignoring one area of obvious application of it. That's the point that he's getting at. Did the second bell already ring? We're having a mass exodus from the classes early or something. Okay, I guess we're through. All right. Thank you, folks, very much.